Item number six, program briefing. Dr. Rich.
Thanks, Chairman Smith. Members of the Commission, Rich Harris. We've met before, usually in the context of hunting seasons, and I typically introduce myself as the person who deals with bighorn sheep, mountain goats, and moose, and pronghorns, and sometimes don't even remember to talk about that. But it's a pleasure today to focus on pronghorns, and I thank you for the opportunity. Just to begin, a couple of notes. Pronghorn antelope are classified in the state of Washington, both by RCW and WAC, as a game species, but we don't talk about them much because there is no hunting of pronghorn for reasons that should become obvious if you don't already know them at the rest of this talk. And I also want to start out by saying that I think pronghorns are really cool. It's really neat that we have some around, and I want to make that statement up front because some of what I'm going to say subsequently could be interpreted as pouring some cold water on that enthusiasm. I don't want it to be all cold water, but I do want to provide a balanced picture of what we know about pronghorns and where we're going with them, or what we think. Until some years ago, if you looked at any book about the pronghorn antelope, Washington would be completely missing from the map. The historic range of pronghorn was not generally considered to include Washington. That changed. So there's just a number of different maps that you can see from various work that was done. That said, I think there were Native American tribes who would dispute that, and there was some feeling that there was some history and tradition of pronghorns being on the landscape. And in 2007, this work by Lee Lyman, who's a sort of a ethnographic anthropologist, I think pretty much conclusively showed that there was some evidence that pronghorns had been on the landscape in eastern Washington historically. The black dots, black colored townships represent places where he felt comfortable there was evidence of archaeological findings of pronghorns, and the open squares were places where they'd looked but not found any. Obviously, he didn't bother to look in places where you would never expect pronghorns to have existed. That said, the situation with pronghorn is qualitatively different than, for example, bighorn sheep, which were also extirpated by about 1900, but which we have really good evidence of exactly where they were and, you know, that they were present until in memory. That's not really quite the same case with pronghorn, which apparently were, it's not as though they were abundant and then extirpated by the advent of European settlement. They really weren't around even in the 1800s, or were very rare. So I think it's for background. I think it's useful to see what Lyman's conclusion was. And apologies for, but I'll go ahead and read it. Pronghorns were rare in eastern Washington in the 19th century, and likely had become locally extirpated by the beginning of the 20th. Because the route followed by immigrants was closed, and eastern Washington was marginal habitat for pronghorn over the past 10,000 years or more, so it didn't take too much human predation to deplete local herds. And I'll talk a little bit about transplants in the past, but why they've failed is is unclear why they failed, but he suspects the reasons include a naturally marginal habitat where agriculture-related land use practices have now rendered unhabitable for pronghorn. I don't want to paint too dismal a picture, but I think that's an important background. There have been a history of the department, or the previous department, prior to all of our time, reintroducing pronghorns. In the late 30s, pronghorns were brought up from Sheldon National Wildlife Refuge in Nevada, and this is a table providing the history of that. Apparently, at some point, they got over 100 animals. I should say that the documentation, the monitoring of these animals was not what we would consider standard these days. Back then, this was before the days of radio telemetry. There were folks doing what they could and picking up anecdotal reports. So this is all a little bit unclear, but it was clear that by a few decades later, there were none left. A second attempt was made in 1950, and there were over 80 animals at some point, but again, dwindled ultimately to zero, and then again in 1968. Now, it's possible that the reasons for these failures had to do with the techniques of rearing or the animals selected or not enough animals. I can't really say. I do think it's interesting that at that time, the folks who were doing this thought of themselves as introducing animals and not reintroducing. They weren't aware of the archaeological evidence of previous pronghorn existence at that time. So about 13 years ago, we did our predecessors did an assessment of pronghorn potential for the possibility of reintroducing. By then, it was clear that pronghorns, in fact, did have some kind of a history in the state. And the work done by George Tsukamoto, who then was became the game division leader, document is on our website. If you want to take a closer look at it, I can send you copies. If you want to look at it, he used two kinds of approaches to assess the habitat potential. One was what's called a habitat suitability index, the old Fish and Wildlife Service modeling of building a little structure of vegetation types, topography, those kinds of things. And then he actually went on the ground and did his own, sort of more qualitative assessment. This is a little bit too small to read, and I apologize for that. But these were the different areas that they looked at. And a couple of takeaways. He did come away thinking that there were probably some areas that could sustain pronghorn populations if reintroduced. However, I would say that none of the assessments were ranked extremely high. His best rankings were sort of in the fair to middling range. He didn't come away saying, wow, whiz-bang, we've got some places that clearly are going to do great for pronghorn. But there were places that he thought were possible. But the other interesting aspect of this is that the two assessments didn't necessarily even line up. His first and second choices for the one didn't correspond with the other. Some of these areas are places where we actually now have pronghorns. So there was obviously some prescience in his analysis at that time. Well, we got pronghorns, not so much due to efforts of the department, but due to the efforts of two tribes. And the first tribe out of the gate was the Yakima tribe. They have been interested in pronghorns for quite some time, had a plan hatched. They got together with Safari Club, which is responsible for a lot of the funding here, and they deserve a lot of the credit for the success we've seen thus far. At the time, the department wasn't terribly they were not antagonistic, I think, but a little bit sort of standing on the sidelines. One concern expressed at that time, my understanding, is that the Department of Agriculture was a little bit concerned about the possibility that these animals would bring in diseases that would be detrimental to livestock. They were all tested, and I think that issue, I think, has receded because I don't think it was ever a real legitimate issue, one that to look at, but it was not something that I think has continued. For better or worse, in 2011, January 2011, pronghorns brought in 99 animals. A few of them were wearing the old fashioned VHF collars. None of them had GPS collars. And so there was some tracking, but not a lot of really good follow up on how they did. Subsequently, we got together with the Yakimas, and these reports are also available on our website. We've now done two aerial surveys to try to get a sense of how many pronghorns there are. So it was clear from the get-go that not all the pronghorns stayed on the reservation. They were all released on the reservation. Something on the order of a third left the reservation, so it quickly became clear that we had joint responsibility. So we've done two aerial surveys in conjunction with the tribes now, and we are planning on doing another one. I've got written there January 25th, but things change, and so that looks to me now more like it's going to be in mid-February of this year. So we've got that. The first one was funded by Safari Club. The subsequent two have been funded out of our budget. We fly together with tribal biologists, and it's a real good opportunity for us to share. And I'm pleased with the fact that we can write a report that has joint authorship of both the tribal members and us on that. So I think that's been really good, and it means also we need to share information about where they are. So the first one, we counted 132, about half on the reservation and about half off. In March of 2017, we counted slightly fewer, but we think that was largely matter of the conditions not being as good. These were the old-fashioned count, which you can see. We had hoped to be able to employ more rigorous methods to estimate sightability and estimate how many we didn't see, but the number of animals we were seeing, the conditions didn't really allow for that. So it's an index. We know we're missing some animals, so I wouldn't take the decline, or the lower number, 121 as compared to 132, as indicative of a decline. Then, in October of 2017, the Colville United Tribes got into the act, and they brought in some additional pronghorns from Nevada. They brought in 52 from the same area of Nevada. There was apparently that, subsequent to that, I think we got a bit of a harsh winter, which can be tough on pronghorns. And there was considerable mortality of those animals. We got some reports. We don't have a lot of detailed data on how that went. We know there was some reproduction of those animals. I have a report suggesting that there were at least 11 fawns from that. Later in 2016, there was a count of 40 animals. So if there were 11 new ones, that might, there were quite a few deaths of the adults. Again, not all the animals stayed on the reservation. That was a bit more of a surprise, because to get off the Colville Reservation, they have to cross a river, and they did. Pronghorns can swim, and a number of them crossed the Columbia south into Douglas County, and those animals continued to be there. The remnant of that. In October of 2017, both tribes then did a subsequent second translocation. The Yakima tribe translocated an additional 100, again from central Nevada. That was the goal. They didn't get all 100. They got 52 more. So 99 the first time, 52 the second time. So this is some information from the Yakima tribe about their second translocation. And once again, not all of them stayed on the reservation. In this case, I think a majority of them have. I think the best estimate we have is that something on the order of 2/3 of the animals from the second Yakima translocation have stayed on the reservation. But they did, to their credit, put a lot more GPS collars on them this time. And that makes it a lot easier to really track their day-to-day movement. So, this is where it started. This is where it went. No, sorry. So these were translocated to the same spot. Thanks for the clarification. And these ones have stayed there, and then these ones have gone off the reservation. So again, we're in a similar situation where we've got animals that are partly on the reservation and partly off. A bit more detail about this second translocation, again, because we have GPS collars and the Yakimas have been kind enough to share these maps with us, you get a sense that these are obviously individual dots of, this is not the number of animals, these are individual locations from some animals. I don't exactly know how many are represented here. These are animals on the reservation. A big cluster of them have stayed fairly close to where they'd hoped they would go. Some animals have gone off the reservation. This is a relatively recent map. You can see there are some over here, not too far from the Tri-Cities. A couple of points worth noting that you can get from this particular image that I think are important, obviously the fact that some are off the reservation. In some of this more breaky country here, not so much use of that. Pronghorns like to be in places where they can see pretty well, and so very much topography, and they are not going to prefer that. The thing that I find to be reassuring and good news about this is that they have stayed primarily in grazing lands and haven't spent so much time in the irrigated agriculture land. We hope that will continue to be the case, may not forever. Just a close-up of the same set of data from animals off the reservation, which is the main concern we have, because we're obviously in charge of doing surveys off the reservation. We're not welcome to do surveys on the reservation, but we work together, the same pilot, the same planning goes into one day on the reservation, one day off. So this is very useful for us in planning our survey effort, and I will note that in all three cases, we've had ground observers organized by Safari Club to be on the ground as well and try to get a sense if there are animals that we're missing from the air. It's kind of a partial correction. So we're trying to do the best we can to get a sense of how well they're doing, but I can't claim that these are highly rigorous, scientifically valid surveys. So one last indication of where some core areas are. Again, the core in this most recent Yakima translocation is on the reservation, but we also know that there are probably some animals in here that are not represented that are results of the 2011 translocation. There's been reproduction, and so animals that are not wearing any kind of telemetry. And the second translocation by the Colville tribe happened at the same time, and that was 98 animals. So no wonder I get confused, because they sort of switched places, 98, 52, 58, 98. Most of those animals are also wearing GPS collars. And as in the previous one, some of them ran across the river, mostly to the south, a few to the west in the Okanagan area, but mostly in Douglas County. And this is a map and updated information we have from the Colville tribes, showing kind of concentration areas. North of this red line is the reservation. South is off the reservation. And some area counts that the Colville tribe has been doing, their minimum count was 99 on the reservation and 43 off of the reservation. And I should mention, I forgot to earlier, that this presentation is a slightly abbreviated one of the version of the one you have on your in your packet, and I apologize for that, but we had to remove a few slides. So what are we doing? Well, we've not been as active as the tribes, fair to say, and this is a good opportunity for us to address that a little bit. We have always been interested in collecting observations of pronghorns when we can, animals with collars, animals without collars. We've got this little sort of database we keep. When anybody sees a pronghorn and I find out about it, or any of our biologists find out about it, we at least try to make a record of that. And in some cases, this has resulted in observation of pronghorns that we think are probably not the result of tribal reintroductions, but almost all of them most likely have been. We have our primary emphasis has been trying to make sure that landowner tolerance for these animals is high. As is pretty obvious, and I'll talk about a bit more in the future, almost all these animals live on private land, and the private owners didn't ask for them, but they're there. And so the good news is that pronghorns, by and large, are not a difficult species to get along with. They are small, have small footprints, have little dainty little mouths, and for the most part eat forbs. And as I've shown you before, so far have stayed on grazing lands. But they can, in some cases, decide that they have a taste for croplands, particularly if there's a rough winter or rough summer, drought conditions. And that hasn't occurred yet, but we want to make sure that we are staying on top of that. And so informing landowners, keeping in touch with them, being responsive to any concerns they have. So to that end, we have this webpage, Living with Pronghorn Antelope, talks about what they are, what to expect. They do have a chapter in our existing game management plan. And our goals are fairly general. As time and funding permits, monitoring the existing fragmentary populations to anticipate the point at which time more active management may be necessary. As time and funding permits, work with private landowners to assure that conflicts with agriculture are minimal. And similarly, as funding permits, investigate the possibility of landowner-driven introductions. And I'll leave more talk about introductions to the very end. We put in the game. There's poaching is concerned. We've heard anecdotal reports of a few poaching incidents. While I understand that most landowners are tickled pink to have them around, there could always be somebody who's not, or who doesn't understand what's going on, who has just got a bad attitude. So we wanted to make sure that at least people understood that they're on the landscape, how to differentiate them from mule deer. So this is in the pamphlet, the big game pamphlet. As I said, we've been wanting to keep on top of the private land issue, and by and large, it's been really quiet, which I'm pleased to report. We did have a situation this past summer. It gets pretty hot and dry sometimes, as you know, and we did actually have a documented pronghorn that was apparently the interest in shade had resulted in some damage to a tree, and we had our private land people go out and provide some scare-away devices and at least try to make it a little bit more tolerable for that landowner. I don't think that it was a large group. I don't think they were actually eating irrigated crops, but they were in the way, so I don't think that has recurred. So more important is, where are we going to go from here? And as I said, I think we are mea culpa. We've been a little bit behind the times and not being more active, and I think this is a good opportunity to rectify that. So I'm proposing that we do some preliminary management planning. It would be two separate plans, I think, because we've got two separate groups of pronghorn, And the fact is that all of them were brought here by tribal entities. And so it's very important that I think we try to work as closely as we can, not get too far ahead of where our tribal partners are. Were we to say, well, they're ours now, we're going to just move ahead and ignore interests that the tribes have, even though they are not on tribal lands, for the animals that are not on tribal lands, I think that would be a poor decision. So I want to work as closely with the tribes, and the ideal would be to have complementary plans. They don't have to be identical, but kind of working in tandem. To date, neither of the tribes have detailed planning efforts either. So we sort of all have to work together to begin them. And the way I would propose to start that is with having some public meetings in some of the small communities near where the pronghorns are to gather opinions about how they're doing. Do people like them? Do people not like them? If we were to propose various actions, we'll come obviously with some ideas, but I want it to be kind of an open listening session. So my proposal is that we begin with that and then have some draft planning documents. I doubt that these planning documents would get all the way to numerical objectives. I think we want to talk about the possibility of hunting in the future. It is a game species. There is interest in hunting. But I don't think we would get to the point of actually proposing specific hunting targets. Clearly, I would hesitate to do that until we had good populations, but also until we had more clarity of where the tribes felt they wanted to go on that. So the thing I have not talked about so much is the possibility of directed reintroduction that our department would do. Again, it's almost all on private land. So were we to embark on that, we would have to do a SEPA process. We would have to have a lot of buy-in from landowners. As we've been shown, and as we would have expected from the introductions done by the tribes, the pronghorns are not necessarily going to stay where you put them. You might have a great idea. This looks like great habitat. Looks like we've got enough land. The pronghorns may not agree with that. So I think any reintroduction has to be pretty broad scope of looking beyond where you think they're going to go to where you don't think they're going to go, and make sure you have landowner tolerance and acceptance there as well. And it'd be a big job because of private landowners. You probably heard that some agricultural interests are not happy when the department decides to put animals there that weren't there before, even though pronghorns are pretty light on the land. That said, we've had occasions where we've had landowners come to us and express interest in pronghorns. We had a situation like that some years ago in Walla Walla County. Unfortunately, that seems to have evaporated. But should we have landowner-driven interest, I think that would be a lot easier sell for us, and we wouldn't have to be seen as the big bad ogre putting animals on the landscape, but simply assisting landowner interest if it's there. So I think we remain open to that, but we would still have to be very careful to make sure that the enthusiasm was shared more widely than the project proponents. I ran through it kind of quickly, but I expect there might be some questions, and I'll answer them as best I can.
Thank you, Dr. Urso. It was very informative. I do just caution the commission that we have two other items and a tight agenda. So, yes, Commissioner Thornburg.
Thanks, Dr. Rich. Really informative, and thank you also for proposing, and perhaps we'll have a little time for discussion about how to move forward. It was very interested in this as I have sort of watched what our tribal partners have been doing, and understanding that they're now on the landscape, that looking at that first piece in the game management pamphlet, that at some point we need to get a little more purposeful with our management, and I think you've presented some really good suggestions, and perhaps other commissioners have a couple of biology things to think about that maybe you could discuss in terms of looking forward on purposeful management. The first is pronghorn are a migratory species. In those kinds of species, there tend to be some that are more migratory, some that are sedentary, how that's driven. So if you could talk a little bit about that, because that I think impacts our thinking about, will we have more of these because they are migratory, or are they staying put? And then the second piece is in terms of managing them on private lands, Pronghorn respond quite differently to fencing than other ungulates. And I know that Colville's are doing some stuff about that. So if you could bring up some ideas about fencing, I think that would be very helpful.
Great. Thanks, Commissioner Thorburn. You've reminded me of all the things I forgot to talk about. So, yes,
within time.
Pronghorns are capable of being migratory. They're also capable of being sedentary. I think in the case of a place where they haven't traditionally been there all the time, what we're looking for is evidence that they can sustain themselves in the face of the variety of climatic conditions that they'll face. So I think one possibility is they're going to do fine. They're going to expand. Another possibility is they're going to have some conditions that suddenly one year we're going to find that they're half their former abundance. They're going to try to move south and have difficulty with fences, or we're going to have significant mortality as occurred in the Colville. So I think it's appropriate to look at this as a hopeful experiment as opposed to a known quantity that, yes, with the right management, we can for sure get them back. I'm hopeful we can. Obviously, the tribes are very hopeful that they can. They put their money on the line. The fencing issue is a real good one. It's a double-edged sword. Pronghorns don't go through fences very well, but you can build fences that they can crawl under. So that's good in the sense that if you've got a landowner who really doesn't want them on their land, it's not if they've got the kind of fencing they can keep them out. It also means that you need, if you want them to be able to move through landscapes, you need to provide pronghorn-friendly fencing. The Colvilles are putting together a brochure and working on educational material for that. We've offered to be part of that effort as well. I think it'd be best if we cooperate on that. But it's a really good point that we can try to work with landowners on the fencing and to some degree channel them where we might like them to be, invite them where we'd like them, and discourage them where we don't want them to be if we can work on the fencing issue.
A quick one. Okay.
Understand they're a game species and were extirpated and reintroduced. But there's nothing in here about ESA or any of the big endangered species analyses. Are they not, or are they endangered species?
No, they're not an endangered species. No, there are tens of thousands of them in other states.
Well, good news story. Thank you. It is a good news.